Our next case this morning is 823-1703. I hope I pronounced this correctly. Chmielewski versus State Farm Insurance et al. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. A respondent will have 15 minutes. And then finally, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel, whenever you are ready, just approach the microphone. You can adjust it to your level, and then just tell us who you are, please, in a loud, clear voice.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Laura Gurney, G-U-R-N-E-Y, and I represent Nathan Stamberski and Twisted Knot Long Log Furniture Company in this case. We are the appellants, and so may it please the court, counsel. We're here today to talk about the required proof in a fire case. So this was a pole barn fire tried to a jury. Almost a year ago now, and the jury came back with a verdict finding that all parties were negligent, and then allocating fault 68% to the defendants, 32% to the plaintiffs. And so we are here. The main issue is about causation. We've also put on appeal the issue of duty and damages, but our primary argument is causation and has always been causation in this case. And so we're talking about whether there's direct, expert, or circumstantial evidence of causation in this case. Now, the parties agree that there wasn't, direct evidence of causation. And the parties also agree that there wasn't expert testimony on behalf of the plaintiff in this case. So the defendants did call two expert witnesses, one private fire investigator, and the other was a deputy fire marshal. And we called both of those.
Counsel, I just want to make sure I understand your position on this. Is it your position that expert testimony is necessary, that our case law requires expert testimony in situations like this when it comes to what causes a fire?
Yes, Your Honor. My position is that it's required in this case. Obviously, it's a case-by-case analysis, and not necessarily...
It's not necessarily in all cases.
Correct, yeah. Not necessarily in all cases, but you have to look at each, case on its facts, and this is a pretty complicated theory of the fire, involving a lot of different issues, flammability, cause and origin analysis, things like that. And so in this kind of a case where you're dealing with those issues, and that's the theory of the fire, that it's our position that expert testimony is required. Thank you. So the parties, the main disagreement here is about circumstantial evidence, and whether there was sufficient circumstantial evidence to justify an award in this case. So as a legal principle, I cited in my briefs that I spent a considerable amount of time researching this in all 50 states and the federal court system, looking for a case in which a verdict was held to be sufficient on circumstantial evidence, without direct evidence, without expert evidence, and I was not able to find a single one. And so I did cite that to the court.
And by not able to find a single one, do you mean one where there was a conflict between an expert and circumstantial evidence, or any case that used circumstantial evidence?
A case in which it was just circumstantial evidence to support the plaintiff's case. And so it's actually very difficult to find fire cases in which there's not an expert witness on behalf of the plaintiff. I mean, usually there are experts on behalf of both parties. And then Many times there's a battle of the experts, right? A disagreement between the two as to what the cause was. And so most of the time you will find that sort of scenario in the cases in which, and there are still defendants who argue that proximate cause is not met even when it's supported by an expert opinion. And those are the ones that are more often to see. But yes, that it's just solely circumstantial evidence to support the plaintiff's theory of the fire.
How about were you able to find any cases where jury was allowed to weigh lay witness testimony on plaintiff's side versus expert testimony from the defendant?
I did not see that. I did not find cases to that effect.
Counsel, if I may, as I'm sure I didn't look as much as you did, but I tried to look too. And one of the things that did was lead me back to some of our case law that didn't involve fires, but have involved this often perplexing issue of causation. And so I was looking at the recent Staub case, Staub versus Myrtle Lake Resort, if you were familiar with that. There's a woman who falls down stairs at the resort, but she's not alive to tell us what caused her fall. And one of the things the court did there was they looked at the plaintiff's theory, which was, well, it was the dangerous conditions of the stairs, and they compared it to some other theories. She could have seen a mite, a mouse. She'd had a replaced knee. It could have given out. She lost her balance. And the court there looked when they're looking at this issue of causation and said, well, was the plaintiff's theory, at least as good as, if not better, than these other theories, the mouse theory, the balance theory. So could you, thinking about it in that respect, your expert has talked about it could have been these other things. Are you saying that those other options, mechanical theory, the mice in that case, in this case, are a better explanation than respondent's explanation here?
I am because, Your Honor, if you look at the record, if you look at the testimony from the expert, there was not any testimony that the plaintiff's theory of causation of ignition of this lacquer overspray was a plausible explanation for this fire, was a potential cause, that the lacquer overspray was a competent ignition source, things like that. Those questions were not asked of those expert witnesses, which could have laid more of a groundwork for the claim. Whereas Doug Noah, which was our fire investigation expert, he did testify. He testified that this fire could have been caused without the negligence of any party. He testified that the cause couldn't be determined without speculating. He said it was very possible that it could have been an electrical cause, a mechanical malfunction, animals chewing on wires that caused electricity to arc. And as far as the electrical piece of it, he also testified that the whole building was energized. So maybe a little bit different for a typical pole barn in that there was electrical service throughout the whole building, and that electrical was a big potential cause. So yes, that is our position on those
But I mean, the
different.
jury was free to reject that expert testimony, right?
Well, you're I mean The jury, I, the case shouldn't have gone to the jury because there wasn't evidence of causation that was presented at summary judgment. And so that's why they didn't have causation evidence to weigh, right? Like the evidence that's cited by plaintiffs is evidence of breach, not of causation.
What about your client's statement, acknowledgement? It had to be the heater that started the fire. That's the one that caused me to think, yeah, maybe this should have gone to the jury. And then we have the jury's decision here to help me with that one.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, we did argue that that shouldn't have been coming into evidence. That was part of our motion in limine.
But you're not appealing that. That's not before us. It's an issue on appeal.
Correct. I'm just saying as background. And when we argued that at the motions in limine, I brought up this issue of potentially using that, as causation evidence. And we argued that point at the trial court, and the trial court said, this isn't evidence of causation. This isn't opinion evidence. He said it was coming in as an excited utterance or a statement against interest. So we did address that before the trial even began, and that was the parameters that were provided by the trial court. And, you know, my client's testimony at trial was that he does recall this date in, it was August or September, right, before the fire. And he recalls Matt Shimoleski asking him to clean up the floor because, you know, the footprints, there was some tracking out of this material. And he did clean up the floor. He cleaned it up. He did not recall there being, you know, a discussion of cleaning or maintaining the unit heater.
I guess I wasn't focused so much on that part, but as it was the statement about what started the fire, it had to be the heater, which, I mean, may have come in under an exception to the hearsay rule, but doesn't that go to, wouldn't that fairly go to causation?
I mean, our position is that it doesn't, Your Honor, but I mean, yes, I understand.
Well, did you ask for an instruction to that effect?
I'm sorry.
Did you ask for a jury instruction saying that statement is only coming in as an excited utterance or a declaration against entrance? You are not to consider it as, you know, having anything to do for causation because this individual is not an expert. Did you ask for something like that?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I'm trying to think back to all those discussions, but I don't believe that was a part of the jury instruction argument.
Well, isn't that a problem? I mean, I understand you didn't want it in. I understand why you didn't want it in. I understand how it came in, but I don't think there's any instruction to the jury that says you can't consider the evidence, you know, for what it is. And so since they did, and they ruled this way, you know, why can't that go to causation? Even if the guy's not an expert.
Well, Your Honor, even if it does go to causation, you know, when we look at the case law,
you know, but the case law is kind of old in all candor. And it seems, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, it seems like the Supreme Court has taken a different view on causation of late, and that they want it to go, you know, they don't want summary judgment. They want it to go to the jury, the case that Judge Jessen referred to, the Montemayor case, it just seems to be it's a little different now. So what are we to make of that?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that the Island versus Ferguson case that I cited in my briefs, that's not an old case. That is from, I think, 2022. A lot of very similar facts there, where you're talking about a complete collapse and destruction of the building. You're talking about expert opinions. Actually, there were three that all said that the cause was undetermined. And that case was filtered out on summary judgment, which was upheld by the Court of Appeals, saying that the evidence came to only one conclusion, and that was that the cause of the fire was undetermined. Now, there were circumstantial arguments there, too.
And that was a non-precedential case, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. But that was
I'm just looking at your brief now. That's from the Federal Court of Minnesota.
No, it's a Court of Appeals
okay.
case.
I'm looking at a different one.
The other thing, Your Honor, I would say in response to your question is that looking, you know, I've reviewed lots and lots of cases on proximate cause, and there seems to be a pretty distinct difference between the personal injury realm and the fire realm. And so I hear what you're saying. I do. And a lot of the cases cited in plaintiff's brief talk about proximate cause being an issue for the jury, right? I think there's five citations there. And I read all of them. And most of them are personal injury cases. And so that's a bit different because, especially in the auto context, you don't usually have expert testimony in an auto case. Yes, there are accident reconstructionist experts, and sometimes they come in, but that is kind of the exception as opposed to the rule, whereas in fire cases, expert testimony is the rule rather than the exception. So I would just make that notation for the court that I think there is a difference between those types of cases.
Well, and there's no, I mean, nothing came in at trial in terms of your client having any particular expertise to know where this fire started. I mean, your client was also a lay person who probably wouldn't have been able to evaluate whether it was the electrical box or the heater that had started this fire, since those seem to be the two potential sources given the location of the fire.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
What testimony, if any, was elicited regarding his ability to evaluate that, or why he would have made this statement with regard to the heater?
There was really none, Your Honor, at trial. And that was one of the things I did argue on a motion in limine, is that, our position was that the plaintiffs didn't have the expertise, to determine cause and origin of a fire. And I said that that also applies to my client, right? That none of these parties have that expertise to make a cause and origin determination. I see I only have like a few seconds left, so I think I'll just exit that point, turn it over to my opposing counsel. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning. I'm Patrick Neaton, NEATON, representing the plaintiffs and now respondents, Severin Shimoleski and Daystar Management Group. I would like to address the question that Judge Jessen raised. Is it necessary to have an expert? Is there any Minnesota case law that says you got to have an expert in a fire case? When we argued the motion for summary judgment, and by the way, that was before Judge Lehman as well, who of course was the trial court judge later. He asked that very question. Is there any case law in Minnesota that says in a fire case you have to have an expert as to cause and origin? And counsel had to admit, no, there is no such case. And counsel says,
But is there a case that has survived summary judgment, or a mo that has survived summary judgment or another similar procedural posture where one side presented an expert and the other side presented a lay witness, which I think is what happened in the Island case, which was dismissed on summary judgment for failure to have any evidence of causation when there were multiple experts that said causation could not be proved?
I'm not aware of that precise issue where there is an expert on one side and simply lay in a
Because
judge
I
says.
mean, essentially what this case is wanting to say is that the jury could say that the experts were not credible given circumstantial and lay evidence on plaintiff's side.
Well, we certainly argued that, and that was certainly our position. And counsel refers to two experts. One of them was the fire marshal. Now, the fire marshal came to the fire at about 2 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, I mean, but my question is really targeted at, do you rebut expert, can you rebut expert testimony where the person is certified as an expert and that's the expert testimony? Can you rebut that with lay witness testimony or circumstantial evidence broadly, even outside of the fire context? Like, is that procedurally what you do when you have a certified expert under the rules?
I think that is certainly the case. So the answer is yes.
And what case would you point me to that you can rebut an expert's testimony with lay
Well, that I
witness?
can't do. But in this case, we did not have expert testimony saying ABC was the origin and cause of the
No,
fire.
you have expert testimony that says we are experts with regard to fires, and we are saying no person could determine what the cause of this is. There are multiple potential causes, and anything else would be speculative. And then the question gets sent to the jury whether or not you could pinpoint a cause. And can you, just in general, under our rules, can you rebut expert testimony with lay testimony in that way? I understand your argument that they didn't pinpoint a cause, but I think that the point that they're trying to make is nobody could pinpoint a cause, and that's why you couldn't succeed on a negligence claim.
Certainly, certainly that was the defendant's claim. But that the reason it went to the jury is we had a plethora of indicators of the cause, the origin, and the negligence.
But how is that different than that recent island case, where there were circumstantial indications that the stove was probably the cause? It was probably the cause of the fire, but the experts were like, it was probably the stove, but it could have been these other things. And so anything else is speculation. And we affirmed summary judgment saying you can't, the only actual evidence of the cause of the fire is expert testimony that says it would be speculative to determine the cause of the fire.
In that case, but every case involving circumstantial
evidence.
Well,
how is that case different? Factually, from this case, because I think they're quite similar.
The quantity of circumstantial evidence. And obviously, the quantity of circumstantial evidence is unique to each case. Island may well have been decided correctly. That does not mean that in no case can is a property owner obligated to have an expert in an effort to rebut an expert who says, we don't know. And in this case, the credibility of the experts was not that great. The fire marshal, McLaughlin, closed his files 8 days after he visited the fire. He did not interview a number of the witnesses. He did not have the high-built spray safety sheet that refers to highly flammable materials and the requirement to keep them away from open flames. And NOAA, the hired expert, quite frankly, was worse. I think he undercut the defendant's position because on cross-examination, it came out that he had the high-built safety sheet in his files. He did not mention that to the jury. He did not mention it in his written report. He also had 9 pages of handwritten notes. It's the last item in my addendum in this appeal. And in those handwritten notes, he referred to overspray, sawdust, flammable items. He also, referred to electrical. NOAA also testified that electrical causes of fire are rare. Counsel said, well, it could have been electrical, could have been in the wires.
But you can't prove causation through speculation. I mean,
correct.
I'm struggling to piece together, based on the island case, how when the experts are saying you can't determine the cause, how we can then say the jury was in a position that they could piece together the cause. I mean, that's where I am struggling.
Well,
it would be helpful if you were able to point me to a case where you had expert testimony saying you couldn't determine cause, and then the jury, that issue was allowed to go to the jury when.
Well, I don't have that case.
I understand why, you know, you don't think these experts were strong, but usually that's why you have a competition of the experts, right? I don't think appellant is wrong that most of these fire cases, there's experts on both sides, and that's why it goes to the jury, is to decide which expert is
correct.
Credible.
And we made a judgment call not to call an expert. One, experts are hard to get to testify against an insurance company, particularly State Farm, because so many of the experts work or want to work for State Farm. But I've been trying.
Well, you know, in all fairness, I don't think that's on the record. I mean, you know, otherwise Ms. Gritty could get up and say, well, you know, they couldn't get an expert witness because no expert witness is willing to testify for them. I mean,
I think
you didn't get an expert witness. You didn't think you needed one. And let's just move on.
Exactly. And I think the crux of it is to look at Judge Lehman's decision and to focus on the factors that Judge Lehman specified in his denial of the motion, after the post-trial motion. And what he said was, defendant's use and storage of high built did not comply with the requirements set forth in the safety data sheet. Defendants allowed a significant amount of high built overspray residue to accumulate on surfaces in the leased premises, including the floor and cabinets. Matt Shimoleski told Nath Chambuski to clean up the leased premises and periodically clean the overhead gas heater, but Strambuski did not do so. Now, Judge Lehman could have added there that Strambuski also agreed that he would do that. Now, that was testimony that was disputed, but of course, the credibility issue was up to the jury.
Mr. Neaton, if I may, if I can go back to some of your responses to Judge Larson's questions, I heard you saying, at least indirectly, that you thought the jury had access to some facts, some information that at least one or maybe both of the experts didn't, like such as, I think you talked about the high built safety sheet. So if I'm hearing, understanding your position correctly, could you just summarize for me, what did the jury, evidence did the jury hear on causation that it's not clear the experts knew about?
I think all of the points that Judge Lehman made in his memorandum decision, there's no evidence that McLaughlin, the fire marshal, had any of those items. Because he did not have extensive interviews with the parties. He did not provide us any notes whatsoever. Now, as far as Noah, we know that Noah had notes. We know that he had the safety data sheet, but he did not refer to those in his report. He did not refer to them in his direct testimony. So he had that information and he discounted it. I would say he deliberately discounted it. And that's why the expert who comes out and says, well, I've got all this information, I made this conclusion, and I can't determine it. But then admits that, well, I didn't tell you that I had this information. I had information about the safety sheet for high built. I had information that there was overspray and sawdust accumulating in that area, that leased area. But I didn't mention that in my opinion. So
I'd like to know which piece of this evidence you think best shows that this was not an electrical fire.
Well, for one thing,
because you agree that there's evidence in the record that this could have been an electrical fire.
There is only speculation. Sheer speculation. I mean,
there's expert testimony in the record that there were multiple potential sources of this fire, correct?
Potential. And that's why I say nothing more than speculation.
And so what in this evidence shows that there was sufficient evidence for the jury to say that this was not an electrical fire?
There was no evidence that there was an electrical fire. The evidence that we submitted was that the electrical work had been done by professional electricians. This building had been functioning as it had, as it was on the day of fire for over 30 years.
But isn't the same thing true of spraying this overspray, that this overspray had been sprayed in this facility for a number of years? Even the prior tenant was using this facility for a similar thing, that this heater had also been in this, right? I mean, part of the problem with this case is I think all of the actors were acting using the property the way that they had normally been using it for a significant period of time. And so I think the same thing can be said with respect to the heater starting the fire as it can be for whether the electrical work started the fire.
Well, except for the timing. The timing on this is Strambuski was the only person in the building that day. May have been the only person in the building for the previous several days. He was certainly the only person that was using a highly flammable chemical. He admits that there was overspray. Matt
But this
saw
fire
the
happened
overspray.
4 hours later, right?
Excuse me?
But this fire happened 4 hours later, right?
About 4 hours after he left.
So he would have sprayed even earlier.
Yes, he had sprayed earlier. And that's why I say the timing is significant. When he left, he set the thermostat down to 50. He knew because of the frigid conditions that it would kick on. He admitted that in his testimony. So we know that 3-4 hours later, that open flame kicked on and the fire started in that area. Everybody admits that.
Does the record indicate, counsel? Okay, so he set it at 50. Does the record indicate what it was when he left?
No.
Okay.
No.
And what evidence do we have in the record that the heater actually kicked on?
Mr. Sambuski.
I mean, that's pure speculation that it turned on at 11:30, isn't it? I mean, what you wanted the jury to infer was that it was a cold night. Sometime between, it would make sense that 4 hours later the heater would turn on, and therefore you proved that the heater turned on at 11:30, but you don't actually have proof that was presented to the jury that the heater turned on.
Everyone admitted that it was cold. The photographs of the firefighters out there with the water freezing, and Mr. Strambuski's own admission that he knew that it was going to kick on.
But that doesn't mean he knows that it kicked on at 11:30.
No. No, but he knew that it was going to kick on. And that would be the only open flame.
But that doesn't, well, but again, that doesn't go to the electrical fire potential, correct? I mean,
correct. But the electrical, Noah's testimony was, that's rare. And there was no evidence that there was any problem. There was evidence about mice, but the electrical wires were in metal conduit. That was in Noah's notes that he also did not mention. My time is up, but thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. Ms. Gurney, you'll have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple quick points here. Judge Larson, you mentioned the timing issue, and I just wanted to give a little more information. The record does reflect that morning my client did 3 coats of spray, and his testimony was that each coat took about 5 minutes, and then you spray a coat, and then he lets it dry, and then you spray a coat, and you let it dry. So all of that spraying occurred in the morning. Then he went to do an installation offsite. Of other products, and I think he left at about noon, and then came back at about 7:30 approximately that evening to check on everything. It looked fine, and that's when he left the property. So the spring.
What testimony came in at trial with regard to whether this was your client's normal practice or whether this heater was often running when this spraying was occurring?
Yeah, I think he does testify to that, Your Honor, about how he used the space, how he sprayed in the spray booth, how he used an airless sprayer, pointing it down towards the floor, and that he needed the heater to be on because the product that he was using had, in order for it to properly dry, it had to be at, I think he said, 70 to 75 degrees. And so that was his testimony at trial about how he used
so
the
presumably
heater.
Throughout the winter, to the extent he was using this in the winter, this heater was on and being used prior to this date.
Correct. Yep. And I would also mention that this issue of the product in its different forms. Okay, so the flammability in the the solid versus the liquid and the vapor form. So the his testimony is that the heater was on when he was spraying that morning. And the heater stayed on because it has to maintain the temperature for the product to work correctly.
And was there an open, was there testimony that there was an open flame at the time he was actively spraying? I guess, is there testimony about how this heater worked in terms of, is there no open flame once it kicks on? Was there any testimony about that in the record?
There is testimony, Your Honor, about how the heater worked, yes, and how when it would kick on. I think my client did say that you could hear it. I think it was like described as like a whoosh or something like that. So that is in the record in the trial transcript. But I also wanted to mention about the expert piece that we've already talked quite a bit about. I think if you look at the Kenny case, which was cited by the trial court talks about the Kenny case and saying that the jury doesn't have to accept undisputed expert testimony. Now, I read that case, and that is true if there is a reasonable ground to dispute the expert's testimony. And here, there was no impeachment of the experts. There wasn't a reasonable ground to not.
Oh, wait a minute. I thought I just heard Mr. Neaton say one of the experts was impeached because he didn't have the safety sheet in front of him.
I mean, being at trial, that expert was not impeached. I mean, you can talk about what was in his file, but his testimony was very clear that, you know, he said, yes, this sheet was in my file, but it did not go to his opinions of the case. It didn't go to...
wouldn't it go to his credibility? Wouldn't it go to the value of his opinion and credibility as a witness if he's not reviewing a document that takes away from his testimony in terms of what the safety sheet says about the flammability of all of this stuff? I haven't been in district court for a while, but sounds like impeachment to me.
Well, I think, Your Honor, if you look at his testimony, when he explained all that he did to investigate the fire, that you will see that he did not consider that to be an important part of his cause and origin analysis. I mean, I think that's clear from his testimony in the record.
Ms. Gurney, if I may ask you a question, yes, similar to what I asked Respondents Counsel, was there evidence that the jury heard, including the statements on examination from your client, that the experts didn't have?
So you mean the trial testimony?
Yeah,
itself?
The trial. Okay. I mean, because I assume that some of what came out at trial, the experts had already learned through their investigations, right? But my sense was that there were some things that, you know, were testified to at trial that the experts didn't know about, or were in addition to at least what they learned about. So that's my question.
I'm out of time. May I
respond? Please answer it. Yes.
Okay. Your Honor, no. So there's the two experts. So you have Doug Noah and the data safety sheet. The jury's heard about that, you know, and that came into evidence. Doug Noah had that in his file. You know, opposing counsel has already, you know, mentioned that. So other than that, no. And then Mr. McLaughlin, the deputy state fire marshal, he wasn't asked those questions. And so the record just really doesn't speak to it
Did the experts know that your client stated shortly after the fire happened, when asked what started the fire, it had to be the heater? Did they know that when they gave their expert opinions?
I'm not sure.
Thank you.
I think that concludes our questions. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Gurney. Thank you, Mr. Neaton. We will issue our decision within 90 days.